This is John Daly. The program which follows needs a map of Africa. Almost any map will do, so long as it shows that curving, clear-cut line which surrounds 240 million people and the countries in which they live. A map shows lines and shapes, and for this is useful. But there is a line and shape to certain events now taking place in Africa, and we must be concerned with these events as well. They are coming to a climax this year. In many ways, as you shall see, 1960 is Africa's year.
Africa, the year of change. A program produced by United Nations Radio, to be heard in many languages in many parts of the world. Produced towards the end of greater understanding of the needs and the drives which characterize the age we live in. Based on words said and things done in Africa, in other parts of the world, and at United Nations headquarters in New York. Africa, the year of change.
We begin in the south, near the southernmost tip of Africa, where two great oceans meet and merge. A man spoke not long ago to the Parliament of the Union of South Africa. He was a visitor from another continent. But what he said in the shadow of Table Mountain linked together 1,000 diverse actions and emotions, and wove from them one African tapestry.
The wind of change is blowing through this continent,
said the Right Honorable Harold Macmillan, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
The wind of change is blowing through this continent. In different places, it takes different forms. But it is happening everywhere.
The growth of political consciousness. A fact with 1,000 faces. A fact in Cape Town, where the British Prime Minister is speaking. Equally a fact in Cairo and Khartoum and Accra, in Dar es Salaam and Kampala and Usumbura and Lusaka. And each manifestation of that fact of political consciousness may take a different form. In a small West African village, the people gather in a political rally. Thousand miles away in Nairobi, a crowd of 20,000 has assembled at the airport to welcome an African leader on his return from negotiations in London. He tells them,
"My brothers, today is a great day for Kenya. Now it is we who can open or close the door. Kenya has become an African country. Whose country is it?"
Ours, shout the thousands, as other thousands have shouted in other capitals, as thousands more are still to shout. In East Africa, they join in the watchword,
Uhuru!
In West Africa, the cry is,
Freedom!
In Rhodesia and Nyasaland,
Kwacha!
In the Congo, and in the lands of the community,
Independence!
There is hardly a corner in all Africa today where such words are not heard. They constitute the unifying force in a continent once classically disunited, once dark, or seemingly dark to the outside observer. A continent now preoccupied with emergence, rebirth, repossession, graduation, New, this force certainly is. But it has already achieved much. Statistics, very well. In the decade of the 50s, the population of independent African countries nearly doubled. In 1950, Africa's voice in the United Nations consisted of four countries with a total population of about 50 million.
Egypt, now part of the UAR, charter member, 18 million.
Ethiopia, charter member, 18 million.
Liberia, charter member, 1.25 million.
The Union of South Africa, charter member, 13 million.
Compared to the figure which stands at the start of the 60s, 10 nation members, 100 million people. The newcomers on the world scene.
Libya, December 14, 1955, 1 million people.
A former Italian colony, a battleground of the Second World War, achieved independence with the help of the United Nations.
Sudan, November 12, 1956, 10 million people.
A land of the Nile, cotton, camels, and cattle. A former condominium of Egypt and the United Kingdom.
Morocco, November 12, 1956, 10 million people.
Territory once ruled by France and Spain, formed into a new independent kingdom in the 50s. A once renowned center of Arab culture and power.
Tunisia, November 12, 1956, 4 million people.
A North African republic, formerly a French protectorate. The site of ancient Carthage, wheat farmers and shepherds.
Ghana, March the 8th, 1957, 4.75 millions.
A nation made from the British colony of the Gold Coast and the trust territory of British Togoland, cocoa and palm oil. Great hopes for aluminum production.
Guinea, December the 12th, 1958, 2.5 million.
Formerly French territory, voted for independence in the referendum of September 1958. Bananas and coffee. Yes, these are the countries which joined the world community in the 1950s or before, which speak for Africa in the United Nations today. 10 countries in all, 100 million people.
This room is the goal, the General Assembly of the United Nations. My job usually is to provide the commentary on meetings of the General Assembly and other important UN bodies, but there's no meeting on now. The room is empty, except for a few guided tours threading through the public galleries, which makes it a good time to reflect and to recall. To note that most of the countries which sit here, most of the 82 UN members, have come here or have come to nationhood following a revolution against some other country's rule. Often their journeys to independence have been hard and long. Their admission to this room, the final seal on a costly victory. And their welcome here has always been a memorable event, something of an occasion for everyone here, particularly perhaps for those of the older members who have themselves gone through such an annealing process.
This rebirth of Africa should go on at a quickening pace so that Africa should...
The man who spoke those words was not himself an African, but he was the representative of a great nation once dependent. Arthur Lal of India.
This rebirth of Africa should go on at a quickening pace so that Africa should take its proper place in the councils of the world. Too long has this been delayed. Too long has the world got used to looking at itself from certain selected points of vantage on the face of the earth. And too long has this given a distorted picture of what happens and what it is that is to be done today in the world community.
We have had in this room no shortage of evidence that the process which Arthur Lowell speaks of is underway. The people who come here and the things that concern them reflect vividly the things happening on the ground in Africa.
And while the world community adjusts its composition and character to reflect the changes on the ground, that ground itself keeps on changing. No day goes by in this year of 1960 without some aspect of Africa's revolution finding its reflection in the news. In London, for example, capital of the nation whose African dependencies, after the war, embraced one quarter of the continent, one third of Africa's people.
London, Friday. The governor of Tanganyika has been empowered to announce that the territory will be granted internal self-government following the elections to be held in September 1960.
In France, which in 1946 held sovereignty over 4 million of African square miles and which ruled 50 millions of its people.
Paris, February 11th. Negotiations began today between the governments of France and the République Malgache, which are expected to culminate in announcement of an independence date for Madagascar.
But these European capitals are not the only places where events in Africa are influenced or decided. A moment ago, we spoke of the United Nations and its relation to the African Revolution in one sense, as a goal for independence movements, UN membership being the ultimate diploma of sovereignty for those engaged in nation-making. But the United Nations is more than this. It provides a frame of reference, an informal court of equity for the forces involved in Africa today. In several critical African disputes, the World Organization has acted in accordance with a principle once set out by the late Ahmed Bokhari of Pakistan, that revolutions could actually take place within its house, in its conference rooms.
Wherever you find a revolution, please drag it into the United Nations as quickly as possible so that it should be controlled, balanced, and bloodless.
But there is an even more direct role than that one, a more immediate connection between the World Organization and the present phase in Africa. It lies in that part of the organization's machinery known as the International Trusteeship System. The Secretary of the Trusteeship Council of the United Nations is Frank Cottrell.
A number of countries which govern overseas territories have signed agreements with the United Nations. By these agreements, they have undertaken to govern the populations of their trust territories, as they are called, with the interests of the inhabitants only in view. Further, these territories are to be brought, by progressive stages of development, to a point where they are ready for self-government or independence. Further still, that process of development is to take place out in the open and with the guidance of the United Nations.
Of the African nations due for independence in 1960, three are direct graduates of the UN trusteeship system. They will have come to their maturity, their nationhood, following a development watched over for years by the United Nations. On the first day of 1960, independence came to Cameroon, a large territory situated where the West African coastline makes its great right-angle bend. Cameroon was once a German colony, then a League of Nations mandate, governed by France. Since 1946, France has governed this land and its 4 million people by the lights of its trusteeship agreement with the United Nations. To the celebration of Cameroonian independence on the 1st of January 1960 came distinguished visitors from overseas. Among them was the Secretary General of the United Nations. What the Secretary General said to that independence audience was this: the road to independence is not always easy. It has not been easy for the Cameroon, we know. In less than an hour, the curtain will fall on a chapter in the history of the Cameroons with which the United Nations has had a close association during the past 14 years.
With its goal achieved, the responsibility of the United Nations has come to an end, and the Cameroons will take its place as a member of the international community of the 20th century. ...800 miles to the west, another embryo nation state, another graduate of the UN's trusteeship system, is on the eve of its maturity.
The borders of my country were not made in Africa. They were drawn in Berlin in 1885 by Bismarck and representatives of the other colonial powers of the day. They were drawn with a ruler on paper.
The Republic of Togo has a similar international history to that of the Cameroons. German colony, League of Nations mandate, French trust territory, and finally, through the UN trusteeship system, independent nation. It was not long after that election day that Prime Minister Sylvanus Olympio told UN Radio how the news of the granting of independence had been received by the 1 million people of the Republic.
The people were almost in tears with joy that we have at last succeeded of getting the administering power of the United Nations to agree to our independence. And not only agree to it, but even welcome it.
It is no small journey from Lomé in the Togo Republic to Mogadishu in East Africa. Nearly 4,000 miles over desert, mountain, and forest. But though we have traded the Atlantic Ocean for the Indian, it is still Africa. And it is still 1960.
I would call this an experiment in guidance from dependence to independence.
The man speaking is Mohammed Hassan El Zayat, chairman of a United Nations Council which has had a major share in bringing Somalia to the eve of independence.
This is the first time that the nations of the world have decided that a former colonial power would administer its colony and nurse it, so to speak, towards independence and maturity. The Italian Republic has engaged itself towards the United Nations to make this country completely independent.
A nation not rich and not populous. 1 million people, a vast area. Bananas and a hope of oil.
And this peaceful operation, this peaceful passage from dependence to independence, has been accomplished, I think, to the satisfaction of all concerned. The Somalis have been sheltered by the family of the United Nations and have been guided through this peaceful passage.
July the 1st, we'll see Somalia's name written in the roll of independent states of the world. In the destinies of Somalia, Cameroon, and Togo, the United Nations' interest will always possess an extra dimension. For these are nations the world helped make. In the very heart of the continent of Africa runs a great river. Its name alone, potent enough to conjure legends. The course of this river draws a vast semicircle around 1 million square miles of Africa. And this land, too, will be, by mid-1960, an independent nation. This is Africa of the storybooks. That part of the continent deemed the most impregnable, the most intractable. Here the explorers came last. Here the going was always the most difficult. Here the jungle resisted most fiercely. Henry Morton Stanley had literally to cut his way through undergrowth before he conquered and handed over to King Leopold that entity known as the Belgian Congo.
I set out for you, gentlemen, the proposed timetable. 8 March,
Introduction of the necessary bills in the Belgian Parliament. 5th of April, nomination day for the Congo's...
A vast storehouse of minerals, diamonds, tin, copper, a grower of coffee and cotton and rubber. The Belgian Congo has more than 13 million people.
And for the Chamber of Deputies. 20th of June, inauguration of the government. 30th of June, first meeting of the Congolese Parliament, the proclamation of independence.
The word revolution has been often defined. If we use it in this African context to mean a startlingly swift overthrow of an established system, then what has happened in the Congo meets the specification on every score. To observers of the African scene, no event of 1960's crowded calendar is more startling than the Congo's graduation. Like the Niger River, which names it, like the vastness of the land itself, independence comes to Nigeria with massive, measured tread. Peaceful and ordered, the natural passions channeled constructively to the steps of a planned timetable. Nigeria is Africa's greatest nation. Its people number 36 million. On the map, it is a federation of three large territories. On the ground, it is a mosaic of 250 tribal groups speaking 60 languages. A graduate in 1960, October the 1st.
We have thrown no stones, fired no shot, and we have not shed a drop of blood.
These are the quoted words of Obafemi Awolowo, one of Nigeria's most prominent political leaders.
We are attaining independence by peaceful, orderly, and democratic methods.
The date was set 3 years ago. In December 1959, a Nigerian federal parliament and government were chosen through a national election. The way is clear. Cameroon, Togo, Somalia, Congo, Nigeria. But the pace of the African revolution is such that even as this program is prepared, there is news of agreement about the independence of two more African zones: the Mali Federation of the Western Sahara and the great island of Madagascar, now known by the name of Malagasy Republic. For these two lands and their 11 millions of people, independence is certain. Perhaps even independence in this year of 1960. And what will it say, this newly reinforced voice of a continent? How will it face the world into which it has graduated and emerged? It is no wild prophecy to assume that among its first concerns will be the revolution to which we have devoted this program.
Toujours, c'est le même cri déchirant qui retentit à travers tout notre continent. Indépendance. Ainsi,
the scene is the General Assembly of the United Nations late in 1959. The voice is that of the President of the Republic of Guinea, Sékou Touré. Translation.
Always it is the same burning cry that echoes across our continent, independence. Independence and unity are today the two irresistible forces which are shaking Africa, enlisting all its vital strength. Too long excluded from free human enterprise, too long held on the sidelines of history, Africa refuses from now on to remain on the back lines of history.
This new African voice, speaking for the newfound African will, what will it say of some of the other world issues? How will it stand, for example, on the dominant conflict among the major powers? In the General Assembly, Sékou Touré answered,
"It is not Africa which should be asked whether it belongs to one camp or another. It is rather to the two camps, to the East and the West, that we must put the fundamental and paramount question, yes or no, are you for the liberation of Africa?" We are too sure of ourselves, too confident in the future. We have too much faith to bring any rancor or envy, any petty interests or obscure intentions to the fore.
It is enough for one program to point out that this voice, this new force in the world, exists. It exists, and on the central issue, it speaks up loudly and clearly, and unanimously. Leaders of states, as new as this morning's newspaper. Leaders of nations, independent since recorded time. Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia.
እስካለፉት ዘመናት ድረስ የአፍሪካ ጉዳይ የሚመከርባቸው ጉባኤዎች ሁሉ
Only a few years ago, meetings to consider African problems were held outside of Africa, and the fate of its people were decided by non-Africans. Today, the people of Africa can at long last deliberate their own problems and future.
That much is achieved, and more. There is a new personality at the world's conference table. There is an entity called Africa, which can only grow in power and influence. It has a will and a voice to speak that will. A wind of change, said Harold Macmillan. A wind of change blowing through Africa. Sometimes a gentle breeze. Sometimes a force strong enough to uproot a forest. But there, always there, a fact. A fact with a thousand faces. In the early centuries of the Western calendar, the embryo territories which have today become France and Britain detached themselves from the Roman power. In 1776, the United States of America willed a withdrawal from the British Empire and backed that will with force. In the 19th century, the nations of Latin America graduated from their former colonial status within the realms of Spain and Portugal. In our time, Asia has removed her destiny from the hands of others, has taken into her own grasp the making of Asian decisions. And this year of 1960, this is Africa's year.
The program just concluded has been Africa, the Year of Change, a United Nations documentary about the African political revolution. Africa, the Year of Change, introduced the words and voices of Harold Macmillan, Arthur Lal, Frank Cottrell, Dag Hammarskjöld, Ahmed Bukhari, Sylvanus Olympio, Mohamed Hassan El Zayat, Obafemi Awolowo, Sekou Touré, and the Emperor of Ethiopia. The program was narrated by Ralph Camargo, directed by Warren Somerville, written by George Marvshin, and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio in cooperation with the Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company.